In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. Okay, writing myself a note, and now I will do my prayers, the four dharmas of Gampopa, followed by the aspiration to excellent conduct. Dharan sam chantam che locha sudro arzinji lakti sol, che lam bidro arzinji lakti sol, lam trupa sa arzinji lakti sol, trupa yeshe sucha arzinji lakti sol. I pray for blessing, may my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing, may the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing, may the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing, may confusion arise as wisdom. Lai ke dang lu dang nu jen ke chubum dadami ke nam dang drawa kunchi drake jitsam har tam che ke du daki chutin to. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of humans and of demons too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. the reminder for arousing bodhicitta. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So we're going to do something slightly different with the meditation today. We're still going to do it within the context of the two wings of awakening, but we're going to take a little time and sort of merge it with our verse for today, which I will put on the screen. All right. Maybe we'll start, like before we do our meditation, we will do our read through of the verses. We'll just read the name of what each practice is until we get to our verse, which is number 8. Number 1, to study, contemplate, and meditate. Number 2, to leave my homeland. Number 3, to rely on solitude. Number 4, to let go of attachment to this lifetime. Number 5, to give up negative friends. Number 6, to rely on spiritual friends. And number 7, to take refuge in the three jewels. So those are the preliminaries. We have finished them in one sense. In another sense, we've just gotten an introduction to each one. We have like the blueprint of how to disentangle ourselves from samsara. We have to keep working on all of those fronts. All 7 of those fronts require sort of continual nurturing because our habits are so strong. And before we do our meditation, I just wanted to touch in on verse 7 again, to seek refuge in the three jewels. And we talked last week about the importance of doing it throughout the day. And I wrote sort of a quote, bonus unquote, post in the class notes online, reiterating that advice. Lama Norla Rinpoche suggested we do it first thing in the morning. Take refuge, like say the prayer or just think that the three refuges are present. And when we first wake up, it's really helpful to take refuge. And Rinpoche said it helps eliminate obstacles during the day. Before we go to sleep at night, helps avert obstacles in our sleep and bad dreams, according to Rinpoche. Anytime we're setting out on travel, just the way we would do the Om Nang Si Nam Dak, prayer of auspiciousness. Many of us don't know that by heart, but you could say the refuge prayer. And Rinpoche says it has the, you know, a similar effect, taking refuge. And so what I suggested, first of all, you know, the contemplation for last week, which again, we should continue like all of our practices of the preliminaries, is to really notice what we turn to in times of stress, in times when we feel like we need comfort or protection. Where do we go? Do we go to the freezer for the ice cream? Do we pull up Amazon and do some shopping? Do we zone out with TV? And really notice that. And I had a really lovely quote from Pema Chodron that she was quoting from somebody else, and that's in the post. I'm not going to go there, but it's a very funny and yet very useful suggestion about how to notice that we're taking refuge in things like ice cream and TV and so forth. The suggestion that I make in the post is to find what Thich Nhat Hanh calls a bell of mindfulness in our lives. And it could be anything that happens on a recurring basis and tie taking refuge to that so that we remember to at least flash on the refuges, at least remember that we are under the protection of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and to say the prayer if we can. And my personal one that I'm aspiring to is whenever I pick up my phone. We use that for distraction a lot, so it's one of the worldly refuges, but it's something that we do throughout the day so much, and if we could remember refuge every time we pick up our phone, that would be a lot of refuge support during the day. And if you can't remember, and I can't, you could put a post-it note on your phone, or you could use like a picture of the Buddha as your lock screen for a while, whatever it takes to nurture that habit. So this brings us to verse 8. And we're going to chant that three times together now before we do our two wings of awakening. Some things coming in. John, I'm not turning off screen share because I have it up there so that we can chant the verse together. So I'm going to leave it up for now. I really, you know, if it's interfering with the video, I'm sorry, but we need to use the screen share right now. So we're going to chant together to refrain from harm at all costs. The suffering of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. And again, trying not to lose the train of the meaning of each phrase. The suffering of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And one more time. The suffering of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So I will stop the screen share, hopefully everybody has a copy of the verse, because we are going to be using it for the meditation, but since it's a guided meditation, it's also okay if you don't have something to read from. It's always probably helpful if you print out the updated verse list that I send you, every helpful to have that printed out for class, but fine if it's not. So we're going to start the meditation. Does anybody have anything that they wish to say or ask before we go into the meditation? Marilyn, I'm going to unmute you.
Would it be possible for you to send out what you just did on screen share? And I know it goes ahead of what we're doing, but that way I could just print it out and I wouldn't keep printing things out because I carry
on. I am planning to. I didn't have it before, but I'm planning to send it out. Yep, because we're going to talk about the next three verses all together, although we'll focus on each one in its turn. So thanks for that reminder. Anybody else? Okay, I'm making myself a note to make sure that I do it. Okay. And I'm working just barely ahead of where we are in the class, so I'm usually only a verse or two ahead, so we will have to reprint fairly often. All right, so we will check in with our posture, as always when we begin meditation, just taking a moment to make sure that our back is straight and our body is in a stable position, feet on the floor parallel to each other, hands in a stable meditative position. Gaze in a stable position, like not looking all around. We can have our eyes slightly open or we can have our eyes closed. And that the body is relaxed. And taking a moment to check in with how the body feels, just letting our attention fall, sort of descend from being up in our thoughts to being present in our full physical body. And within that relaxed, sort of alert relaxation, that sense of being fully present to our experience in this present moment, whatever it may be, whether it's outer experience or inner experience, we're going to very briefly today contemplate the four reminders, because it is good to begin every meditation session or practice session with the four reminders. First, remembering the precious human existence. Impermanence and death. The law of karma, cause and result, which is our topic today. And the suffering of samsara. And having reinforced our sense of why we're engaging in this practice, now, again, within our posture and our presence in the present moment, we will use a small amount of our attention to follow the breath for a moment. And having brought our attention somewhat to rest, we will now follow Trungpa Rinpoche's and Pema Chödrön's basic instruction for cultivating ultimate bodhicitta or wisdom, rather than going through the four steps, we will simply flash openness in Pema Chodron's words, or touch on open awareness, which is the background of all our experience, always with us. Just tune into open awareness and rest in that. Letting go of all thoughts and concepts. Just completely open, receptive. And now to cultivate relative bodhicitta, we usually go straight to taking and sending, but today we're going to do it as a guided meditation based on verse 8. And I'm taking some of the guided meditation from a book called Essence of Ambrosia. It's the teachings of Taranatha on the three types of practitioners, or the three levels of practitioners. And this is like the very expanded form of verses 8 through 10, the three ways of approaching our practice, which are considered to be stages. And we'll talk more about that in a bit. And so he spends some time on each stage. And at this stage, where our practice is to refrain from harming others in order to avoid suffering, to free ourselves from suffering, we're going to contemplate the kinds of suffering that we're aiming to free ourselves from. And at this point, we're just thinking of ourselves. We'll bring others into it because we're on the Mahayana path. But the first stage, you just realize you're suffering and it can get worse, and you want to find a way to head that off. And the way to head it off is the theme of this verse, to refrain from harm at all costs. So I'm going to chant this verse again, and if you have it, you can chant along. The suffering of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So again, we're in sort of a meditation mode here, and I'm just going to say some things and offer some contemplations and practice. But so Thotme Zangpo starts out by pointing out that the suffering of the three lower realms are very difficult to bear, even sometimes unendurable. And I think we often gloss over that. So today we're going to, with Taranatha's help, we're going to explore what that feels like, what that suffering feels like that would be so motivating to us to avoid it, that it inspires us to set out on the path to awakening, the first stage of practice. So first we're going to imagine that we, and there are other beings with us, but we're focusing here on our own personal suffering. Imagine ourselves in the hell realms. First, the hot hells. And it's a much longer description than I'm going to share today. So if you have this book, or if you want to explore it further, this is a really good resource. So Taranatha says, and we're going to just imagine ourselves in this as he describes it. All the hot hell realms have these characteristics in common. There are no mountains or valleys on the surface of the earth. The ground is made of burning iron. Flames constantly blaze an arm's length in height. Jagged ravines and precipices cut through the landscape. And we're imagining this now. I'm asking that we all imagine this as like a physical place, because this is the way that the hell realms are classically described, but we also know them to be states of mind. So just imagining, we all know that what sends us to the hell realms is anger, in this case, hot burning anger. So we could, if it's easier, just imagine this is metaphorical, and this is what intense anger, being trapped in intense anger, feels like. but we can also imagine it as literally like the landscape we're in. So water here takes the form of scorching molten copper, molten bronze, molten lead, and boiling salt water. That's the only liquid. The rivers and lakes are composed of these substances. Even the trees are made of scalding iron. These realms are full of harmful birds, carnivorous animals, karmic demons, and murderers. Fire made with sandalwood is 7 times hotter than ordinary fire. The fire in the first hell realm, called reviving, is 7 times hotter than that. So let's just imagine ourselves in all of that heat. Likewise, the heat of each lower hell is 7 times greater than the one above it. The mind of a being in the hell realms is extremely sensitive. It is stabbed and clouded by feeling. A hell being's body is soft and his flesh tender like that of a newborn baby. Both body and mind have little tolerance for pain. So our suffering in the hot hells is particularly intense. So let's just imagine vividly for a moment that we are really there. We are really experiencing this intense suffering from the heat of anger. What it feels like to be trapped in it with no escape. And so now, jumping ahead a few verses, we can apply taking and sending and just breathe in the suffering of this hot hell. Breathe it into our heart center, let it dissolve, and breathe out coolness, refreshing, cool moonlight, the antidote to all the suffering that we're feeling. And now to look at the cold hells. In all the cold hells, so we're done with the hot hells. We can have a break now. Just resting the mind in open awareness. We can always go to open awareness or ultimate bodhicitta when we don't have content for relative contemplation. In all the cold hells, the ground, mountains, and valleys are snow and ice, slashed with crevices and ravines. Violent icy winds and snowstorms rage constantly over the landscape. The winds are so cold that they penetrate the skin and chill the flesh of the beings there to the very bone. Each of the 8 cold hells is 7 times colder than the one above it. So imagining an extremely intense experience of winter with no protection. And that is the feeling of the cold hells, cold, frigid anger. So imagine that we are trapped there in this frigid cold with no escape for eons on end. We breathe in that suffering, letting it dissolve, breathing out warmth, peace, happiness. All right, now we can take a break from the cold hells, and we're going to skip the other categories of hells and just go straight to the hungry ghost realm now. And again, the verse says, the suffering of the 3 lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear. So what would it be like to be trapped in the hungry ghost realm, or to be in the psychological state of neediness of a hungry ghost, insatiable neediness? And Taranatha says, if I think, what if I were not born in a hell realm and instead were born as a hungry ghost? Would I be happy then? He says, when I consider the matter, I would not be happy. There are two types of hungry ghosts, those who live underground and those who live scattered about. And to be brief about it, the ones who live underground are 500 miles under the ground, and the ones who are scattered about. He says, there are countless hungry ghosts that move through space on the earth and under the earth. If I had clairvoyance, I would be able to perceive that hungry ghosts are everywhere. They are unable even to find a place to go or a place to live. In general, all of these hungry ghosts suffer unbearably and constantly from hunger and thirst. So let's just imagine for a minute what that would feel like. Suffering unbearably and constantly from hunger and thirst that is never satiated. They do not have clothing, so they are burned when it is hot and freeze when it is cold. In the winter, even the sunlight feels icy. In the summer, even the moonlight burns them. When it rains, they perceive the drops as hot coals scorching their skin. At all times, unable to find sustenance, they experience the misery of exhaustion and weariness, and their bodies become emaciated from lack of food and drink. Flames leap from the 360 dislocated joints in their bodies. Because they perceive one another as enemies, they catch, bind, beat, and stab one another and experience the fear of being killed. Furthermore, because they are naturally timid and fearful, they feel extreme terror for no particular reason. So let's rest in that for a moment, that feeling of being a hungry ghost. Terrified, hungry, thirsty, cold, hot, completely unprotected from any elements or any kind of physical suffering. Breathing in our own suffering as a hungry ghost. Breathing out relief, whatever is needed. And then to the animals, the last of the lower realms, whose suffering is unbearable and that we want to avoid at all costs. So animals living in the ocean, we're now an animal living in the ocean. They have no source of protection and they wander aimlessly, carried about by the waves. They eat one another, constantly anticipating a predator's approach. They are afraid and miserable. They endure such unbearable miseries as being eaten alive, and so forth. So imagining the suffering of animals in the ocean, in bodies of water, and imagining that suffering for ourselves. We can breathe in our suffering, breathe out peace, lack of fear, lack of danger. And then animals who live above ground, animals that are scattered about. These are the animals living among humans and gods. Wild animals constantly live with an uneasy mind because they are innately anxious about approaching predators. So animals in the wild don't have a moment's peace because there could always be someone swooping down upon them or pouncing upon them and eating them. Domestic animals endure the hardships of being shorn, having their noses pierced, of being beaten, being forced to carry heavy loads. They endure many sufferings associated with being enslaved or killed for their meat, blood, skin, and bones. In addition, they endure hunger, thirst, heat, and cold comparable to the suffering of the hell beings and the hungry ghosts. Their principal suffering is that of ignorance. Not knowing better, they prey on one another and live in constant fear of being chased by a predator that is after their meat. So imagining ourselves as an animal, perhaps living in the woods. Did we do that one? Yeah, maybe an enslaved animal, an animal about to be led to the slaughterhouse. Breathing in that suffering, breathing out relief. Breathing out, being released into a beautiful pasture in a place where it's always temperate and nice and there's always food. So now we'll bring the Mahayana motivation into it, our bodhicitta, and imagine all sentient beings in addition to our own selves. Whatever suffering we may have, breathing it in, dissolving it, and breathing out the antidote. And thinking now that through this practice, we and all sentient beings are completely freed from all suffering, completely filled with happiness, and completely awakened. Now resting again in open awareness, letting go of all visualization, all conceptuality, just resting. Completely open, completely receptive, no thoughts or judgments, just resting. And now coming back to our ordinary awareness, ready for study and contemplation. Does anybody have any questions or comments about the meditation or anything else? Okay, so, I don't see anybody with a question or a comment, so we'll go ahead. So back to the verse. I'm just going to bring it up on the screen for a moment again. To refrain from harm at all costs, because the suffering of the lower realms is so difficult to bear, and we all have some sense of all of these states of mind, probably just as a psychological state based on current circumstances and experiences from moment to moment. If we really contemplate these extreme sufferings of the lower realms, the hell realms and the hungry ghost realm and the animal realm, we would want to avoid them at all costs. So that's the first noble truth, that there is suffering. These sufferings exist. All of our experience, in fact, is permeated by suffering, whether we're aware of it or not in any given moment. The good news being that there's a cause, and that where there's a cause, it means that the cause can be removed. And if the cause is removed, then the suffering ceases. And so this is the content of verse 8, practice number 8. the problem is suffering, which can be quite extreme. The cause, according to the teachings of the sage, this kind of suffering is the result of actions that cause harm, of harming others. That's the most basic understanding or explanation of what karma is. If we do things that harm others, that creates suffering for us in the future. So therefore, knowing that, we must refrain from harmful actions in order to free ourselves from suffering. And it's so important that we should refrain from harm even if our own life is at stake, even if it means that we'll die. And this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So this verse is within the context of the main practice. We have now moved from the preliminaries to the actual practice. And if you look at the verses and the way that they're described, I think, putting aside Paramatta and going to very briefly the heart of compassion. So on page 87 of the Heart of Compassion, we're only going to be in this book for a moment today. He introduces part two, the main teachings, illuminating the path, which begins with verse 8, by saying, after the seven topics of the preparation comes the second section, the main teachings, which explain the paths for beings of lesser, medium, and superior capacity. And actually, these three verses constitute like the entire path. They encompass all of the rest of the 37 practices. If you look at the textual outline, which is on page 39, moving to page 40, if you have the book, it's okay if you don't have the book. But if you look at page 40, the main teachings illuminating the path, part two, that's where we are. And it has three main headings, and there's no heading after it that is equivalent to it. Everything else in the entire 37 practices is subsidiary to these three verses. So they could look like, it could look like it's just a description, these three verses, of the three kinds of paths. And then, oh, look, the actual path we're doing is under the third path. So it seems like almost an academic distinction here, but actually the path begins with verse 8. This is like stages of the path, not like different paths for different people, but it's within the Mahayana, it's considered to be the stages of the one path towards full, complete awakening. So I just wanted you to be aware of like how important these three verses are. And I don't think we're going to go back to Dingo Chensi today, because there's lots of good advice in this chapter, but I found another presentation to be organized in a way that I was easier for me to work with. So we'll get to that in just a minute. So the path then is going to begin with refraining from harm, which is, we think of it as the Hinayana, the Theravada, the foundational, the Shravakayana path. That first path is based on not harming others. That is the first foundational step in the path. And without that step, if we don't do that, there is no path beyond that. There's no path that isn't based on first stopping any harmful actions that we're engaging in. So that's what we're going to look at today. Briefly, I mean, we're all very familiar, I think, with this idea. And this verse is considered to be the description of karma. So most of the commentaries focus on karma here. Karma is about, again, you know, in The Torch of Certainty, Zhangong Kongchul says that we can't understand karma until we reach the first bhumi, until we're actually an official certified bodhisattva. And that happens when we first become able to see things as they really are. It's not stable yet, and we don't have the compassion piece fully developed yet, so it's not full awakening. It is the cessation of suffering. It's the cessation that the Buddha talked about in the Four Noble Truths, because the first turning of the wheel was really about this path, the path of freeing oneself from suffering. So by removing
by refraining from harming others, we're now solidly on the path. And that's a huge thing. Just like the preliminary practices, this is not something that we touch on and yeah, I got it, and then we're off to the next thing. It's like this is a continual effort on our part to see where we're harming others, how we're harming others, intentionally and unintentionally, and how we can stop that habitual pattern, that very strong habitual pattern, without which we wouldn't be stuck here at all. So let me get some extra papers off of my desk. So the preview is that, so verse 8 is to refrain from harm. Verse 9 is to strive for unchanging freedom. That's where we realize that, like in the first verse, to refrain from harm, we're just trying to free ourselves from suffering. That's it. And then at a certain point, we realize we're still not free. We just got a better samsara. But if you really understand samsara, you understand that even the pleasures and the comforts of samsara contain suffering. And even if you can't find any other way that they contain suffering, they're impermanent. You know, the gods have it all. Like that would be like aiming for the gods' realm, is to be free from suffering. The gods don't have any suffering. That's why they don't turn to the Dharma. But at the end, when their time is up in the gods' realm, that's when the suffering kicks in. So there's even suffering there, but it's put off until too late, basically, to keep them from falling to the lower realms. So to refrain from harm at all costs, that's the foundational step. That's the, you know, Shravakayana vehicle. Second one is a description of it's stage beyond. It's not really full Mahayana until 10. To strive for unchanging freedom means that we realize that we not only need to free ourselves from suffering, we need to free ourselves from samsara, the good and the bad, the pleasant and the unpleasant, the praise and the blame, all of the worldly concerns. We have to free ourselves even from the good parts of samsara because it's still a prison, it's still a trap. And then in the third stage, which is what everything on the path will follow from this, is when we realize that even if we free ourselves from samsara, it's not complete liberation. And why is that? It's because of interdependence, because we are connected to every other being that exists throughout limitless space. They've all been our mothers is going to be the theme. And if we're happy, but they're suffering, we're not free yet. Like nobody's free yet. We have to free them as well. So that's the path, and we are at the beginning of it. And again, jump in or signal me. Hopefully, I'm looking. If you'd like to say anything at any point or ask anything at any point. So we have commentaries by Dingo Chensei. We have commentary by Ken McLeod. The best commentary I thought on this was actually from Transforming the Heart, which I used in a previous class. Transforming the Heart by the Gelugpa teacher Geshe Jampa Tegchok. And this is translated by Thubten Chidrin, which is a name we know. We might not know who Geshe Jampa Tegchok is. This is like my personal favorite commentary on the 37 practices. But since it's Gelugpa in the Kagyu tradition, that's probably not going to make it our main text. But if you're really interested in exploring these teachings in greater depth, then this is a really great book to have. And on this particular topic, verse 8, I think it's just the best because it is just incredibly well organized. It's a lot of the same material is in the Heart of Compassion, but it's just a little bit more, like the order is a bit more random, and it's hard to see how one thing follows from the other, but here it's very clear. And obviously we're not going to have time to read the whole thing, although it's not a long chapter, but we're going to hit the highlights of it. But first, before we see what Geshe Jampa Tegchok says, I don't know if everybody saw the contemplation that I asked everybody to do for this week. It was to think about what ways we harm each other in. And as all of them, I think, point out, but especially Geshe Jampa Tegchok is going to lead us through this, our basic handbook of harms to avoid is the 10 negative actions or harmful actions or unvirtuous actions. So here is our silent pop quiz for today. We're all longtime practitioners, so we should be able to dredge up all 10 of the unvirtuous actions in their categories of body, speech, and mind. So we're going to just take a moment and Google our internal file system and see if we know all of the 10 actions that the Buddha advised us to avoid. So there's three of body, three physical ones. And there's four of speech. And then three of mind. And maybe it's hard to come up with them on the spot with such a little tiny bit of time to do it in, but do it sometime when you have leisure, like at the beginning of a meditation session, perhaps. Recite or review mentally the 10 unvirtuous actions, and then we know what we need to adopt and what we need to reject. This is the rejecting part, and then there's the 10 virtuous actions that are the counterparts. So I'd love to hear from people if you have any comments on this. How do we refrain from harm? How do we harm people intentionally or unintentionally? It's not like a confessional thing. But for example, I find lying very hard to avoid, 100%. There are things called white lies, as we all know. And it's very clear in the Buddhist literature that they're included as lies. They count as lies. But sometimes to avoid a greater harm, what seems like a greater harm, we say something that's not quite true. Or to protect ourselves instinctively, we might spin something a little better than it really is or whatever. So that's one that I come up with for myself, like the constant challenge of being truthful, in a constructively truthful. It's fine if no one has anything they wish to share or say. Because we're going to go through Geshe Jampa Tekchok. He's going to take us through these. And again, unmute yourself if you have anything to say at any point. Oh, Marilyn, I'm going to unmute you.
The easiest thing to think of for me in this particular aspect, showing how difficult choices, is when I think of Chonam going into retreat and what was told in order to his family to make that happen.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's a really big thing. I mean, there are smaller things like, no, I can't come because I've got another appointment, as opposed to, no, I don't really want to come, or it wouldn't be hurtful to come, or whatever.
Yeah. So where do you draw the line?
Exactly.
Well, in case people aren't familiar with Chonam's story, he's one of the lamas in Richmond. He did the retreat number 6. His family is very, very deeply fundamentalist Christian, and they live in a very rural area, and that's how he grew up, and he could not tell them. They don't know he's a Buddhist, let alone a lama. They don't know he did 3-year retreat. They think he spent 3 years. He did tell them he was going to Tibet, and that he was going to teach English to children or something like that. So he kept that up. Well, actually, we stayed, my family, my husband, daughter, and I rented Soltram's house in New Hamburg when they went into the third retreat back in 1991. And our job was to lie to their parents. They were traveling the whole world, and they actually had friends who were going to send postcards or something. I forget how it all worked, but we got excoriated once because we weren't enthusiastic enough in our, descriptions of what they were doing, and they kept us prompted. But again, it was a situation where it would cause the parents so much suffering. Yes, Valerie. Oh, Valerie, did you want to speak?
No, I didn't. I don't know how that got. I did that. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
But I'm thinking, wouldn't it be healthy for them to hear the truth?
I don't know. I do know that Lama Nyorla Rinpoche himself encouraged people to do this because it's like when people took vows, like they became ordained. I remember in particular Tsupa. I don't know if anybody's been around long enough to have known Tsupa, Elizabeth Callahan. She was in the first two retreats, and it caused her parents so much upset that she was Buddhist living in a monastery, you know, all of this stuff, that Rinpoche actually told her to just not wear her robes, like at home, just take the robes off, wear your jeans. And she didn't do it because she felt it would be dishonest. But Rinpoche thought differently, that there was nothing constructive about the suffering that it was going to put the parents through. So I think it's very difficult, but there's no doubt when you read, just, you know, I mean, so many things in Buddhist literature are like 100% literal. And then we learn that maybe they're not, but that's the way they're expressed. So I don't know. I do know that Lama Nyorla himself has told untruths to the, I mean, I was there at the planning board meetings when we were trying to get the stupa approved. there was like no way that if we told them the 100% truth, we were ever going to build the stupa, which was considered to be of such immense benefit. So it's the point is that it's sticky. This is hard. And beyond lying, not lying is just like a thicket, you know, of peril. It's a minefield. What about stealing? I mean, we may think we don't steal, but I remember Pema Chödrön telling a story. It was some audio teaching I was listening to years ago, telling the story of being at Gompo Abbey. She's like the head of Gompo Abbey, right? And she gets into the shower and she's forgotten her shampoo. And it's communal living and there's shampoo all over the place. And she starts to use somebody's shampoo because she knows that they wouldn't mind. And then she goes, no, wait, you know, this is like taking without being given. And she didn't. And she had to get out of the shower, dry off, put on her clothes, go get her shampoo and come back. Like, have we ever done anything like that? I mean, I've used people's shampoo. I would try not to do it now. Richard, were you signaling?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I read once that the stealing thing, it was if someone would miss the thing. So I'm not sure where I read that, but I like think shampoo thing would be in that category.
Yeah.
It's not really hurting anybody. But what I was going to say is idle chatter is my thing. I'm always idle chattering.
That's a tough one.
My teachers in school said I had diarrhea of the mouth when I was in elementary school. And I know, I mean, I'm aware when I'm doing it, but I still do it. I really like to do that. So that's my hard one.
Yeah. I've unmuted everybody just for the record, just in case anybody has anything they want to say. Yes, well, we're now seeing that it's not so easy. Like, what about killing? Like, I kill constantly, right? My neighbor across the street just, and he knows, like, my feelings as a Buddhist, and he really tries, you know, he doesn't see why we can't kill bugs, but he really tries to be careful and kind on my account. He had ground bees in his flower bed. Like, these are bees that, like, live in the ground, and they come up, and they're very aggressive, and he got stung really badly just trying to fill his bird bath. So he spent the last 2 weeks trying not to kill them. But he finally realized he can't live with them. So he researched online. He tried a few things. Didn't work. These are really smart beings. And finally he flooded their, you know, Omani Pemi home. He flooded their quarters underground. He now has a sinkhole, a small sinkhole in his flower bed because it was a huge complex. But they're gone now. Like, what do you do? What do you do?
It's
overrun with something that you can't, you know. Yes, Richard.
I was just thinking when I'm on, when I have to like exterminate or something, I'll play Kala Rinpoche's mantras for beings before I do it, just because I know I'm killing and I know that I'm intending to kill.
Yeah.
But I'm not happy about it. So I guess, you know, you're supposed to, the three acts or something like that, where the last one is you rejoice in it.
Yeah.
I don't do that, you know.
Yeah, there's levels of karmic, I see you, Patrick, just a second. There's levels of karmic, you know, culpability or something, and they're explained in Transforming the Heart. We probably won't have time to go into them, but yeah, there's, you know, not every act is a full karma, although every act is at least a partial karma. Very good point. Patrick?
It looks like the way that the text is formulated is that the Buddha taught about the cause of suffering in the lower realms, but then from therefore on, it's a conclusion about how, what the action should be. And I think that there's a real risk, a real danger of making rules like we all admit can't be met, because that gives the deciding authority, whoever wrote this clause, a way to say, no, you're bad, and to be judgmental about the action. Like we've all listed a bunch of actions that we're going to do.
Yeah.
Human nature, and it's common sense in society.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I see what you mean, but I think I missed right at the beginning something. So where do you think that this is coming from?
I look at this more closely because I don't, the verse number 8, yeah, that there's a piece there that's the Buddha's words.
Yeah.
Buddha says that this is the cause of suffering.
Right.
But there's a second clause that says, so as a result, don't do, well, what is it? Never act unvirtuously.
Right.
We might all decide that we would act unvirtuously. Everybody has said something. And some things have been consequential. I mean, these things about people going into retreat and not telling their families, that's not inconsequential. But it wasn't really breaking a verse of the Buddha.
Right.
You get what I mean anyway?
Yeah, well, I think that speaks to, you know, that's along the lines of what Richard was pointing out, that there's certain elements that have to come together to make it a full negative act. So if you're telling a lie to spare someone from harm, obviously there's some mitigation there. You're not rejoicing that you're lying. You're not dancing around because you got the chance to tell a lie. It actually is painful to you. And I think that's been true of everybody who's had to do that for the situation of retreat. It's a lot of work to do that. So much easier to just tell the truth. But then 3 years, they're going to be thinking of, you know, what's happening to their child.
Well, on the other hand, there are many, many things in our in the Vajrayana practices that are considered secret.
Yeah.
In the practice itself.
Right.
They're called secret. And people take vows to not tell anybody about them unless they're caught.
I'm definitely not following you on that one. Like, you mean like
practices? Problem with the monastery.
I'm sorry?
The big one is the current problem at the monastery. This year.
Right. Right.
It seemed like it was going to make a difference until it did. And it really, really did.
Right. To whom did it not seem like it was going to make a difference?
People that knew about Rinpoche and him himself.
Right. Well, him himself, yeah. I mean, we could get into a whole morass there. I think people really didn't know. You know, I think it's a really complex situation. And I think what we see is that samsara is very complex. And it's actually really hard to sort out like a black and white answer to anything. These are all really good points. I don't know that, you know, that we're getting to an answer, but I think it's really good to contemplate this question. So I knew someone once, it was someone who did 3-year retreat, who didn't take the sojong vows because she felt, you know, those are the lay vows you can take, not to kill, not to steal, not to engage in sexual misconduct, not to lie, and not to take intoxicants. And she felt that because, like, just by driving her car, she would be killing and she couldn't avoid it, that meant she shouldn't take the vow.
Right.
And that's not the point. The point is to become aware of our actions. And where we have a choice, then we know what the choice would be. But doesn't mean that by, you know, inadvertently killing millions of tiny beings driving our car, that we're breaking our vow. If we're doing our best to keep our vow, then we're keeping our vow. Seems to be the way that it is. If you engage in conduct that obviously breaks the vow and you have a choice not to do it, then you're breaking the vow. But it doesn't
so
mean...
So that would apply to the monastery issue?
I'm sorry?
So that would also apply to the issue at the monastery. I wonder how much faith can you have in these negative actions in hell realms and things like that, mm-hmm. when that was such a big negative action that was obvious and repeated.
Right.
And yeah, I guess that's not in the class, but
well, we actually discussed that in class on verse 6. We had a discussion of that, the situation, and you can find the recording on online. So you could listen.
Okay.
The last 30 minutes of the class are actually a discussion of the modest situation. It doesn't get into
that. I didn't mean to go there. It's just Patrick made me think about it. Yeah. Okay.
This topic lends itself, you know, it invites this question of what is the meaning, what's the literal meaning of the unvirtuous actions, and can we always avoid them? And what happens if we could avoid them, but we choose to, or what if our teacher seems to break one of them? These are all things, but they're not things that we're going to be able to resolve together. There's nothing I can say that's going to resolve it for everybody. We all have to contemplate it. So I think it's a worthwhile contemplation, and the Buddha himself seems to have taught that we should do our best to avoid these actions. And the point, and this came up in the discussion too, the main point is not to harm others. They're presented very literally, and I think that's meant to make us take them seriously, but doesn't mean we can keep them perfectly, or that even maybe there might not be an exception here and there, like that you tell a lie in order to avoid hurting somebody when it's unnecessary to hurt them with the truth. I think we have to be extremely careful about that, though.
I think that they can nudge us along the way. For the example of either mindless chatter or speaking harmfully, gossip. I discovered after learning the unvirtuous activities, I began to realize at work how much I engaged in gossip and who said what, and usually there's something not nice about repeating something, or you know, and that by thinking about this, it nudged me along the way to decreasing that activity.
Yeah.
Didn't
yeah.
make it perfect, but it sort of pushed me. I mean, so we don't kill ants. We don't kill ants in our house. So it pushed us along that way.
Yeah, but,
that's the best I can hope for. That'll just push me further and further along the right direction. As well as saying no to certain things.
Yeah.
I have to say,
Chet.
I mean, even as I'm sitting here in this class and you're giving examples of people at the seminary are talking about things in the monastery, I find my mind doing a running dialogue in judgment of people. So, I mean, it's really hard to step back from this. You know? It's constant. I'm going, well, how do they do that to the family? And why do they, you know, that's still a lie. And or whatever happened, but you said something that really struck me, which was, as I was thinking about that, I was aware that I was doing it. So I think it's the awareness piece that really is the linchpin to all this. It's not even so much the action itself. It's the awareness of it. Even talking about killing ants. I mean, you know, living in New Hampshire, we have, it's a fall, so we have our annual spider invasion. And I really do not like spiders, but I've been trying to let them go. But when my husband works as a nurse in the ER, and he always comes home with his spider stories about people who got bit in the night by spiders and had these horrible infections. Yeah. So I make a deliberate conscious choice now. It bothers me more so than ever, but I bless them before I kill them.
Mm. Yeah.
We're all at the stage where we're at. And remember, like, this is such an important point to remember. In the Torch of Certainty, the very first thing that Zhang Gonghongchul says is that we're not going to understand it. You can't fully understand it until you reach the first Bodhisattva Bhumi, until you have experienced emptiness. We're not going to be able to sort out karma. So we learn what we can, but our judgment is not going to be 100% reliable because we're not Buddhas or even first-level Bodhisattvas yet. We just do our best. And I think the most important thing to keep in mind, and it is the point of this verse, our intention is always not to do harm. And if we can't avoid harm, then our intention is to do the lesser harm. And sometimes we're not going to make the right decision because we're not Buddhas. We just do our best. These are guidelines to help us look at our intention in all of our actions.
And we're in samsara. And unless we're in a cave, not doing anything, we're going to harm.
Yeah, we're going to harm.
I just said the awareness seems to be the key and the effort.
Yeah. So this is about situations where we have control, like where we're making a decision about something to do. Unintentional things we can't help, and we look for ways to be able to be more aware or more careful, but you have to like be a little bit relaxed about it. It's like everything else, alert but relaxed. It's like, okay, I have to drive to the supermarket and things are going to die. Maybe I'm even going to hit a squirrel unintentionally, but you still have to drive because you have to get your food. So I'm going to turn to the commentary now, but we always have the option to take an extra week. I don't know that we'll need an extra week on this verse, but just to give you a flavor of this chapter. And again, the theme of this verse is karma. This is the karma, just like Gampopa in the Jewel Ornament has a whole chapter on karma as one of the antidotes to the obstacles to awakening. We have one verse that is primarily about karma. So he says, the path to enlightenment, it's very clearly stated here, unlike in Dingo Chensi, where he calls it, like, what is it, the three types of beings. He calls it the paths for beings of lesser, medium, and superior capacity. Geshe Jampa Tenshi makes it clear that it's one path. These are stages of one path. So he says, the path to enlightenment can be divided into the paths of initial, middle, and advanced practitioners. So initial as opposed to lesser capacity. Like you're just starting out. So the first thing you look at is that list of 10 unvirtuous actions. And how can I be more aware of my intentions and my actions as I go through my day? Then we're going to add other, you know, things on it. Like how can I free myself completely from my habitual patterns? And then how can I free others from theirs? So he says, explaining the path in terms of these three levels helps us understand how to gradually develop our mind and to progress along the path in a comfortable way. That's the relaxed part. We're not the police. You know, we're not arresting ourselves every time we see a tiny transgression. We're using it as a basic guideline, a touchstone for like measuring or just becoming more aware of our actions and our intentions. Having thought about precious human life and the fact that it does not last forever, the initial level practitioner, that's this verse, is concerned with future lives and thus takes refuge and observes karma and its effects in order to have a good rebirth. The middle level practitioner generates the determination to be free and the wish to attain liberation. And then the advanced practitioner generates love, compassion, and the altruistic intention to become a Buddha in order to benefit others. He said, we will see the unfolding of this gradual path to enlightenment in the following verses, meaning 8 through 10. So now we're at verse 8, and he says, he begins by saying, this verse explains how to observe karma and its effects, which is the main practice at the initial level. And if you want to go into, Fanny has a comment. We'll see if that's something. Can you speak to how to increase self-love so we are not blaming ourselves for our karmic actions? Let's keep that in mind. I would just say keep that in mind and don't blame yourself. I'm not sure what else I can say about that, except that, again, we have to be relaxed about it. Or as Pema Chodron put it, we have to be, she didn't use the word alert, it was a different one. Alert and gentle. And she's gentle can involve humor. It's not like, oh, haha, I just stepped on 6 ants. But it's just like, oh, well. And you do some mantras for them. You play the Kala Rinpoche mantras for them if you're Richard. We take it a little more lightly, remembering that in some sense, it's all illusory. And we're going to get to that, actually. And that's actually, we are going to go back to the heart of compassion for a second to pick up that piece of it, like what's the relationship between everything is empty, everything is illusory of the second turning of the wheel versus we have to watch our every action. So right now we're on the we have to watch our every action part, but Fanny, that's really important point, is that we can't take it too seriously or be too hard on ourselves. It's just an aspiration, and we do our best.
Mama?
Yes, Richard, yeah.
I wanted to say to Fanny, in the 7 points of mind training, you know, it says start with yourself.
Right.
When you're about compassion and things like that. So you start with yourself, right. Which I think that applies there.
Yeah, I think you're right, Richard, thank you. So we're always including ourselves in our love and compassion. We're not leaving ourselves out, and it's a very important point. And as Patrick said, this could all be used as a way to judge ourselves harshly or to judge others harshly, and that's not the point. We're supporting ourselves and we're supporting others as we travel the path and do our best. Mistakes will be made because we're not Buddha yet, and we have to accept that as part of the package. But that doesn't, just because we can't be perfect doesn't mean we don't try. It's important to try. It's important to keep it in mind and accept that we're not going to be perfect. Or, as is said, mistake by mistake, I travel the perfect path. So just to skim over, because we have about 15 minutes left. Oh, wait a minute, Mark has a comment. How about just using these as a learning tool, that is, observe what happens to your mind when you stray into negative actions? And I agree that's an important piece. Oh, I see. You sent that to John privately, but I think you meant to send it to everybody probably.
Yeah, so, I did.
So Mark said, how about using these guidelines as a learning tool and just observe what happens to your mind when you stray into negative actions? And I think that's part of the gentleness, part of the non-judgmental, part of the self-love and compassion piece of it. We're training. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. This is our training, is to just start to notice this. Just as we're noticing what we take refuge in, now we're noticing where we might seem to transgress these guidelines, where we might be accidentally killing or intentionally killing because we have to, or, you know, and so forth. Just, it's all about increasing our awareness and developing our bodhicitta, our intention to benefit others. So Geshe Jampa Tekchok, oh, I have everybody still unmuted. I'm hearing some noise. I'm going to mute everybody, but we'll just, you know, proceed as always. Unmute yourself if you have a comment. So Geshe Jampa Tekchok presents this as kind of a dissertation on karma, like a very, you know, elementary explanation of karma. So he says the topic of karma is presented in two parts, first the general aspects and then the particular types. And the particular types is where we get to the 10 unvirtuous actions. But these are the four things, and you'll see this list of four things to know about karma, the general aspects of karma. Dingo Chensi mentions them in his book, and we see them in Zhangong Kongtrul, although they're not presented in an orderly fashion in Zhangong Kongtrul, but they're all in a paragraph about karma. So the first thing to know about karma is that it's definite. It is definite that negative actions result in suffering and positive ones in happiness. The opposite is never true. And I'm just skimming here from point to point. He says more about each of them. The second one is karma expands. If you've been in the Dharma Path program, then you will remember that even a small karmic action, if it's unresolved, if it doesn't either immediately manifest or you don't purify it through the four opponent powers, it expands. So a small action, a small negative action could turn into a big result in some future lifetime. So he says that what that means is even a small negative action is to be refrained from, because karma increases in size, just like a great tree grows from a small seed. So karma is definite, karma expands. And the third one, the result of karma is not experienced if the cause is not created. So if we don't do something harmful to someone, we're not going to experience the karmic result of that, only if we do it. Somebody else does it, we don't get that result. the fourth one, the result of karma is never lost. So it's not like you do something bad and maybe the universe will forget about it. It's always going to be out there and it's going to be expanding. And this is the way that the Buddha taught it. And these are some of the reasons why we want to pay attention to our actions and try to refrain from negative actions. He says, when we act destructively, the karma does not vanish, even if we do not experience the result in this life. Even if thousands of eons pass by, we will eventually meet with the result, unless we purify this negative karma. And that's a whole other topic. I think all of us have enough experience on the Dharma path to know that there are ways to purify negative actions. So it's important to recognize when we've committed one. You know, and again, Patrick, this speaks to your point a little bit. It's not like there's not a way out. You know, it's not inexorable unless we decide not to intervene or fail to intervene. And the four steps, if we know we've done something, we had to, as Richard, exterminate our house, or we drove our car and ran over something, or we used somebody else's shampoo, or we told a white lie. You want to purify those things because they do carry some karma. And what's the process for that? Let's take a little 20-second silent pop quiz. What is the process for purifying karma, for confessing and purifying our actions? So I think of them as the four R's. The first one is to recognize that we've done it, just to notice. Number one, very important. Number two is to regret it. Number three is to resolve never to do it again. Actually, it's five because I always break up the first one into two. Recognize and regret are one thing in the original Tibetan. Recognize, regret, resolve never to do it again. Even if you know you probably will, you make that resolution. It weakens the pattern. Rely on the three refuges, another opportunity to take refuge, and remediate. Remediation in the Buddhist literature usually means saying mantras and so forth. Like there's ways dharmically you can remediate it, but it can also mean making amends if you can do that. So that's how we purify karma. It's very important to know that. And if you need to review that, it's in the jewel ornament in the Vajrasattva chapter, called the four opponent powers or the four powers. So I want to get to in the few minutes we have left, I want to get to the negative actions, just to give you again a flavor of the explanation. Galupas are so great with this stuff, with the detailed explanations. So he says there are three types of karma, non-meritorious, and you may remember this from the Torch of Certainty, non-meritorious, meritorious karma, and what's called unfluctuating karma. We're not going to get into that today, but it's explained in the book. So his non-meritorious karmas are of many types, but the majority of them can be included within the 10 destructive actions or the 10 negative actions. These are termed destructive or negative because they destroy our happiness and directly or indirectly harm other beings. When this verse advises us to give up negative actions at the cost of our life, it mainly refers to these 10. So number one, killing destroys the life of another being. The negative action of killing means intentionally taking the life of someone else. So it's not a full karma if you run over a million insects with your car. There is still a karmic result, but it's not considered the negative act of killing because it was unavoidable and unintentional. And again, there's a whole huge paragraph on killing here that's very interesting to read. Number two, stealing refers to taking what is not given and harms others by way of their possessions. The negative action of stealing entails stealing from a human being, although stealing from an animal and so forth is also a form of stealing, and he gets into the details of how to analyze it. We complete the act of stealing when we think, I've got it, it's mine, which you probably don't think if you borrow someone's shampoo. Number three, unwise sexual behavior harms others and oneself and others. So the list varies, you know, depending on what, where and when it was written. But I think that's the general guideline, is that sexual activity that harms another being is sexual misconduct or unwise sexual behavior. Lying harms others by deceiving them. A lie can be explicit or implicit, not telling the whole truth, or even nonverbal, such as lying by a gesture. We may say we saw what we did not or did not see, that which we saw, or we may say something is when it is not or is not when it is. Number five, divisive speech. And now we're getting into the ones that I think we tend to engage in the most. I think speech is a hard one for us. We talk a lot. and we have a lot of habits of speech. So lying is an obvious one. That one's pretty clear what it is, even though there's gray areas. But divisive speech, I think, is really clear. Like, we know when we're doing it, even if we're not recognizing it. It refers to causing conflict between people who get along well together and enhancing the conflict between people who don't get along. We may engage in divisive speech directly by speaking to one or both parties, or indirectly by passing on harmful information. In either case, the result is to create disharmony. So to create or exacerbate disharmony between two people, that is divisive speech. That is one of the big 10 acts to avoid. So never say something bad about someone to someone else. You may have information you have to convey, and that's a different thing. You may have to tell on somebody. But divisive speech is much more along the line of doing it with a harmful intention, like just to stir up trouble or make trouble for somebody because you don't like them or whatever. Number six, harsh speech, another one I think we fall into more than we would like to. And it means saying things that hurt the feelings of others, such as angrily criticizing, ridiculing, insulting, or shouting at them. And in other explanations, for example, I think in the jewel ornament, it's expanded upon a bit. A lot more things fall into harsh speech, like even subtle criticism that's meant to undermine somebody, not simply telling them something that has to be told, but, you know, sort of putting the ice pick in a little bit. Number seven, and meaning even if they're not, like, present sometimes. So gossip or idle talk is the last of the four negative actions of speech. This includes, and we're all going to have to figure out where to draw our line. You know, I think we have to give ourselves some slack here, but we do have to understand what it is. So according to Geshe Jampa Tegchok, yes, Fanny, I'll get to that in a second. This includes reading or speaking about frivolous books or films which excite lust or provoke anger. I like to watch things sometimes. So I know it falls into idle. See, to me, that's what it is. It's like reading People magazine, you know, or even the New York Times in a certain sense, you know. It's like, why do I need to spend my time on this when I could be spending it in some constructive way? He says, even explaining a Dharma text while motivated by the eight worldly concerns, such as wishing to receive a good name or offerings in return, is considered idle talk. Although idle talk is the least harmful of the four destructive actions of speech, it is the one which wastes the most time and distracts us from being mindful and practicing the Dharma. Same thing Richard said. Okay, and then we're into the ones of mind, and I'm just going to go through these quickly, and I will get back to Fanny's comment. Covetousness, wishing that you had something someone else has. That's in the Ten Commandments too. Maliciousness, wishing harm to come to someone. Is there any particular, you know, I mean, I think we could think of times that we wish that. It may arise from jealousy. It can also be motivated by resentment, grudge, or belligerence. Something to be avoided even at the cost of our own life, according to Tokmei Zanko. And then wrong view. That's a hard one, you know, to explain, to know. He says wrong view refers to stubbornly and cynically holding incorrect ideas about important topics. For example, we may think it is impossible to become enlightened because the three jewels do not exist, that there are no repercussions to our actions. I think that's a big one. People who think that after death we become nothing, there's nothing to hold them back from committing negative actions. They don't believe in karma. They believe nothing happens to us after we die. I know people like this, and they're good people. They don't take it that far. But that is considered a wrong view, that there's no consequences to our actions. He says, wrong views are fixed and rigid opinions and do not refer to doubt, inquisitiveness, and open-minded exploration of ideas. So it's okay to question things. Is there life after death? Are the bardos the way that the Buddha taught them? You know, do we suffer if we commit a negative action? It's okay to contemplate those and wonder about them, but to have a fixed and rigid opinion about them is considered a wrong view. So we're out of time. The next topic he gets to is to be a complete destructive action. Each of the 10 must have 4 factors. Someone brought that up, I think it was Richard. And it's a very fascinating topic, which you don't find in Zhangbong Kongtrul. So then he talks about meritorious karma and unfluctuating karma, just some more definitions of karma, categories of karma. And then we're at the end of the chapter. It was mostly about the 10 negative actions. He talks about the importance of dedication. Anyway, we have to stop. Oh, he does say, okay. All right, I'm going to try to start this in a good place. He says, we must implement this gradually and continuously because it is unrealistic to expect ourselves to stop all unproductive behavior immediately. Rather, we must choose the behaviors that are the most destructive and work on those first. So pick the one that's hardest for you. And we've been learning this all over the place lately in Gampopa and also here in this you figure out what you need to work the most on and you focus on that instead of a scattershot approach. Trying to look at every single thing may not get you anywhere, but if you know that, like, you tend to yell at somebody or you tend to engage in divisive speech, you tend to gossip, work on that one. Just pick one, work on that. And then, you know, do the other ones, you know, whenever you notice them. Fanny asked a question. How about sardonic wit, which seems to be prevalent? That is definitely considered harsh speech. There is no question. Anything that hurts someone's feelings, that's harsh speech. We want to refrain from that. And Rinpoche has spoken to that in the past too. And I've certainly been guilty of that myself. My sense of humor can sometimes be a little, you know, out of bounds unintentionally. I never mean to hurt anybody's feelings. It has happened before and it's taken me aback, like, oh man, I gotta be careful with that thing. I'm going for the joke and forgetting that there's a person on the other end. So anybody have any parting words? We may do a little bit more on this next week or we may just go on. If people have any thoughts, I'm gonna unmute everybody for a sec. Okay, you're all unmuted. Any feelings about another week on karma versus just wrapping up briefly and going on?
Lama? Yes, I always like anything on karma.
You do like anything
on karma. Going on with it.
Mm-hmm. I saw Marilyn nod. Marilyn?
Well, you didn't nod? I'm always willing to talk more, but I don't want to drag everybody else into something if they don't want to go there.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can play it by ear next week. I think we will go on next week, but we can still talk about karma a little bit more. To feel like we covered it. There's still a couple of interesting points. So, but again, it's kind of an academic thing almost. The point of this verse and the point of karma is just that twofold thing. Refrain from negative actions that harm others and engage in positive or constructive actions that help others. That's all you need to know about karma. You don't need to know the 4 components of a full karmic, you know, result. That's interesting. And it does help. It helps us lighten it up a little bit. Because if you don't rejoice in it, it's not a full karmic act. It's the person who wants to hurt somebody that's really in trouble. Otherwise, it's very nuanced. But it still helps us, I think, to know some of the nuances. It doesn't seem like there are any strong opinions about it. But so let me know if you have one in the meantime, and we'll just see what happens next week. Anybody got anything else to say before we do our dedication? I can find it. Then I'm going to mute everybody again. Let me see if there was anything else I had to say. No, there was actually Pema Chodron's is a bit lovely. So we'll read Pema Chodron's commentary on this next week. And I wanted to remind everybody to check your Zoom account and see if you have any updates. It will help us have like the most the smoothest Zoom experience and the best Zoom recordings if we're all up to date. our dedication, then I'm going to mute everybody again. Dedicating the merit to the enlightenment of all sentient beings, which is practice number 10. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate all virtue fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And we will take a moment to bring our minds to rest. Okay, I'm unmuting people again. And that felt like we packed a lot in, but we had a lengthy discussion, and I think the most valuable classes are the ones where we do hear from people and we share, you know, our own thoughts and insights. So that is always welcome.
Thank you.
Good to see you, Kathy.